we can do it. It'll be worth all the pain. And you say, worth what? What are you going to get out of it? And the only thing that you can take away is a warm feeling of sovereignty. It's a shameful moment in our country's history.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Backstory on Brexit. I'm Dana Lewis. Wait, Brexit is actually more interesting than you think. I mean, it has to be, right? Brexit is much more than Britain leaving the European trading bloc. And it even has some parallels with Trump populism in America. Trump has taught people if you repeat lies long enough, people will believe you. At least some will. To win their referendum to leave the EU in 2016, the British conservative Brexit movement lied a lot too. Boris Johnson came to power by largely misleading everyone that Brexit was good. A trade deal was oven ready, he said. It's not, it wasn't. He lied about European laws overriding British law, about a loss of sovereignty, about threats from immigration and terrorism. In fact, now the UK could be shut out of the European intelligence network, and that'll be damaging. And they dangled promises there would be more jobs and even more money for healthcare if Britain just left the European Union. And people bought it. 52% versus 48% in the referendum vote. Bought it like Americans swallowed Trump's lies about America first and how by pulling back from the international stage that would benefit US interests. It was populist politics based on fear, and still is. So Britain voted to leave but couldn't figure out how to do it. How do you disconnect from Europe but continue your trade relations? How do you lower labor standards and workers' rights and lower environmental standards and still meet EU trading regulations? Oh, and Northern Ireland. They couldn't draw a border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, so the talks have gone on for years. The referendum was in 2016, and now we're at the end of 2020. The talks are drawing to a close because the deadline is now. Britain is out. The question is on trade with the EU, are they still half in? They'll certainly have more fish to sell to the EU, which is where most of the fish caught by British fishermen are sold right now. Britain and Brexit on this backstory. All right, I want to introduce you first to Anna Soubry, who is an ex-conservative MP. She's a barrister. She was a journalist. And I think everything I've read about her and seen about her, you're a bit of a rebel, Anna.
Yeah, that's probably true. And I used to have a very good cause, but I think the cause has somewhat waned now that we've left the EU. But anyway,
I want to talk about that. And also joining us is Irina von Wiese. And I've known Irina for a long time. She's a member. She was a member of European Parliament for the United Kingdom. And right now she is, no longer a member of European Parliament because the UK left the European Parliament.
Indeed, I'm one of those extinct species that is trying to sort of resurrect in some Jurassic Park form and eventually rejoin.
You should wear that as a badge of honor, probably. Anna, first of all, can I talk to you about where we are right now? I mean, it looks like they don't have a deal, but then they might have a deal, but they didn't have a deal, but they could have a deal.
Absolutely.
I let Anna go first, and then I will try as well, but I think speculation is difficult.
Anna, over to you.
No, I absolutely agree. And if you ask, well, what's going to happen? I honestly don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if we left without a deal on the basis that the talks will continue, which of course they're going to have to continue in that event because it's going to be devastating for the UK economy, the British economy in particular. But equally, if he gets a deal, that wouldn't surprise me either. But it will be a bare bones deal, and it will not deliver the sort of economic benefit. Not that there is any benefit, but it won't be. It will just it'll be a bare mitigation of the undoubted economic hit our country will suffer when we leave the single market and the customs union. Now we've left the European Union.
You were a member of David Cameron's government. You supported a referendum.
I did.
You campaigned against a positive response for the referendum. And for you campaigned against the referendum, did you not?
No, not at all. I campaigned against us leaving the European Union. But I am one of those who thought we should have a referendum to settle the matter for decades.
Right. That's what I meant.
Because I felt it needed to be done.
You held the referendum to settle the matter because we have a lot of American viewers. What were you trying to settle? What was going on behind the scenes within the Conservative Party that you said, finally, let's put this talk of leaving the EU to rest once and for all?
Absolutely. So what was happening was that for decades, ever since we joined the old common market, there had been this small group of people within the Conservative Party who believed with a fervent passion that we should leave the European Union as it then became over time, and we should not be in it. And they would bang on, as David and other people, David Cameron and many others called it, banging on always about Europe. And for many of us, we believed that it distracted us from all the other things that we should be talking about. And out on the doorstep, which I used to do a lot of when I stood for Parliament in a very marginal seat, as you can imagine, very few people on the doorstep actually said to you, do you know what my real concern is? We're a member of the European Union. They would talk about all other sorts of things. It was very low down the list of priorities for real people. But for the Conservative Party, it was almost and often the number one only talking point. And it was like a running sore. And it needed sorting out and settling, in my opinion. And that was a terrible mistake because obviously I thought we'd win. We didn't want to have a referendum if you thought you were going to lose it. Thought we would win, and we were spectacularly wrong.
Irina,
for a number of reasons.
Let me bring Irina in here on that note of a number of reasons. What do you think that the pro-Brexit campaign tapped into? We understand what their slogans were. You know, you're going to get more money for healthcare and you're going to have your rights back and you're going to have sovereignty. But what do you think really they tapped into?
Well, I think what they tapped into is years and years and years of a very anti-EU media in Britain, but also the general mood, which was one of disfranchisement of general unhappiness of economic breakdown following the austerity. All of these are, of course, things that have been planted, deliberately supported by the Conservative Party. I mean, my party, the Liberal Democrats, we fought tooth and nail against the referendum, and then later to somehow stop Brexit, we failed. I think these years and years and years of deliberate disinformation and lies come to a head now, because now what we're going to see is that all of the things that we said 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, all along were going to happen, the catastrophic no-deal Brexit is going to happen. I'm not saying this with glee, Dana. I do not want my adoptive homeland to suffer. I do not want my British friends to suffer. And I'm saying this with one crying eye, but we will come back and say, we told you so. And maybe this is the bitter pill that we all need to swallow. Because I think people have understood
is nodding,
now.
Is nodding, curiously, all of this in agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this point about the misinformation, I mean, it was almost like a bit of a British sport to blame anything that went wrong on the European Union. And it was part of the sport was to, frankly, stories were made up, including by Boris Johnson when he worked him as the Europe correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. Stories were made up, and it fed that little Englander that inhabits much of this country. And so it was things like the EU want to ban bendy bananas. I mean, this was all a load of old rubbish. And governments of all colours, Labour and Conservatives, if there was something difficult that couldn't be done, or something difficult that had to be done, they would go, oh, it's not our fault. Wait, it's the EU. They're telling us to do this, or they're not allowing us to do that. So it became a whipping point. And here's a surprise.
So, Anna, what does it become now? Because
we lost. We lost for other reasons, though. Sorry.
What does it become now? Because you're talking about, not you, but the pro-Brexiters talk about independence. And then they are trying to negotiate a dependent trade deal. I mean, there's
that's
a little
what
bit.
They are.
They're conflicting.
Yeah, but But you and I'm sure your listeners, your viewers will know and understand these things. But this is the absolute dishonesty of the whole of that Brexit campaign, was that, you know, you could somehow be this, that we'd lost our sovereignty, which in itself is a load of old nonsense. People used to say to me, we don't make any laws in this country, because I would go out in the streets, you know, places like this here in Leeds, and talk to, you know, people as they're going about their business in the days when they did that before COVID. But, and people would say, yeah, but we don't make our own laws. And I say, excuse me, I am a member of parliament. I make lots of laws. I make lots of laws you don't probably agree with. But please don't tell me we don't make laws, because we do. So this idea that we've lost sovereignty as a member of the United Nations, which de facto means you're going to give up a bit of your sovereignty, as a member of all sorts of other organisations, where, of course, by being a member or having any relationship with any other country, or like us as human beings. I mean, if you're in a relationship, if you have children, if you have neighbours, if you have friends, then you give up a bit of your sovereignty. You know, you say, where should we go this evening? One wants to go to the cinema, one wants to go to a restaurant.
I'm married, you know? I get all that, definitely.
Yeah, but you do, don't you? It's the same with friendship and neighbours and so on and so forth. And about 16% of British laws was subject to EU laws, which often would trump those laws, 16%. And it was usually about widgets, you know, the size of a screw head. You know,
and Anna, you know, these laws were also made by people like me, who I was directly elected, right? I was sitting in the European Parliament making these 16% of laws that apply in Britain.
Exactly.
But I was elected by the people of Britain, in this case, by my London constituency. You know, so it's not like there is no democratic system.
Absolutely.
We made laws, we scrutinized these laws,
and you were accountable
in the European Parliament. But the difference is, we then had a seat at the table. We were actually influencing those laws and those regulations that will still be, you know, applicable directly,
absolutely,
indirectly. Now what we have is a situation where we don't have a seat at the table. We are not influencing these laws and these regulations and standards. We'll still have to follow them. I mean, it's completely deluded to think,
exactly,
that we can simply do our own regulations and standards and whatever if we ever want to have any trading relationship with our biggest neighbors. So we're going to have to follow them, but we don't have a chance to make them, to influence them, to influence any kind of policy, including, for example, a lot of cross-border policies like crime fighting, like the environment.
Yes, yes.
We have to follow it, but we can't influence it. So in many ways, we have lost sovereignty or whatever it may be. We certainly have lost standing in the world, as a nation that has any say. And the recent breach, a complete breach of trust.
Can I just pick up on that?
Absolutely.
Come back to Anna for a moment. Let me come back to Anna for a moment and pick up on what you've just said, Arena. And that is that a lot of people say that this will be a race to the bottom, because now for the UK to remain competitive after Brexit, they are going to have to deregulate a lot of things that they produce, environmental standards, labor practice. But then that puts them into another problem with the EU, because they're going to say that's unfair, that's not a level playing field. In the end, it's going to wind up, even if there is a trade deal, which there may not be, it's going to end up in a real conflict with the EU and sanctions potentially at the end of it.
Yes,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
As a competition lawyer, I completely understand that argument. Sorry, Anna. Just very quickly, you do need to have this level playing field. For the simple reason that if you want to trade, you can't simply undercut the others because you subsidize your own industries. And this whole picture of a sort of Singapore on the Thames, I'm not sure whether that was a good or a bad image of Britain. Of course, the truth is that we will not be able to compete on our own with a block with the biggest trading bloc in the world. And the only way that we think we can do that is by dumping down our own standards. I personally don't want to have my children play with unsafe toys or eat some chlorinated chicken. But, you know, we won't even have the choice because we won't be able to import the higher standard goods.
Let me give Anna a chance.
The thing is, as we are having this conversation between the three of us, this is... it is quite complicated stuff to talk about. You know, normal people in their homes today are not going to be sitting there saying, you know, this level playing field, you know, this deregulation, the race to the bottom. Look, this is not the conversations of ordinary, decent people. These are often complex, difficult things. And it's the absolute duty of politicians to explain things to people. That's been one of our big failings. And it's also a failing, if I may say, of our media. And I suspect, you know, obviously across the Atlantic in your own country as well, where we've had this problem where we've and I'm an old journalist, remember, so I put my hands up to this, where in order to sell a paper or to sell a TV program, you dealt in the simplest of terms. And I once worked for a great news editor who said to me, and he said, as he said to all of us, he said, never ever patronize people by saying, oh, it's too complicated, or that's a long word. He said, don't patronize people like that. Speak good, plain English to people and explain it, and don't just go for that cheap headline. And what's happened to our country is a product of that.
Is the cheap headline, by the way, the fishery discussion?
Yes.
Because
yes.
that accounts
yes.
really for you know, zero point whatever it
zero,
is, point two of the British
yes.
economy. But that's something
Absolutely
Boris
right.
Johnson always rolls out. And
Absolutely.
We're going to protect our fish, and we're going to send our warships out to protect fishing. And least they feel that that resonates with the public.
And it's even more mad because we don't even eat most of the fish that we get out of what is apparently our seas. It's even more bonkers than that. So, yes, you're absolutely right. It's 0.02% of GDP. So it's a tiny piece of our economy. And the irony, as I say, is that even if we gain control of our seas and we're the only people who fish the stock from our seas, we flog it into the European Union. And nobody is saying to the British people, OK, we can catch all this fish, but we won't be able to sell it. So what's the point of this nonsense? And, you know, again, it is this huge failing of all of us involved in politics, not all of us, perhaps, not the Lib Dems, to their credit, have always sold the positive benefits of membership of the European Union, but not to explain these things and not to do this awful, simplistic, jingoistic nonsense
okay.
that we are, you know, we've just come out of the Second World War, which, by the way, you didn't know this, but we won by ourselves. But I mean, it's these sorts of nonsenses. There are still millions of people in this great country who think that we won the Second World War all by ourselves. And, you know, this shooting in the foot is actually, we can do it. It'll be worth all the pain. And you say, worth what? What are you going to get out of it? And the only thing that you can take away is a warm feeling of sovereignty. It's a shameful moment in our country's history.
Anna Sobry, thank you so much. I know you have to go.
I am. I'm so sorry, but thank you.
Thank you, Anna. And I couldn't agree more with Anna. I mean, I think we really are in the same boat here. How does this end? Well, you know, I would so much love to end this interview on a positive note and say this will end with people seeing the light, with suddenly realizing what a huge historic mistake this was, and we're all going to happily rejoin. This is not going to happen in the short or medium term. I'm not deluded like our government to think that this is going to happen overnight. But I think what we need to do now, which is really important, is to pave the path towards a more pro-European attitude. And we can do that despite our government's lies, despite the failure of trade talks.
So is there going to be a deal?
If
he gets a deal, is it going to be a real good?
He's not going to get a deal. I mean, I'm very happy to bet on this. And again, I don't wish this on our country.
So if it's not a deal,
he's going to sell whatever he can achieve as a deal.
This is the perfect storm. People are predicting this is the perfect storm.
Absolutely. And if this doesn't bring this government down, I don't know what will. Because the combination of a catastrophic no deal or some skeleton deal, Brexit, the pandemic flaring back up, in the next year, I think it's going to be, I really think it's going to be the death knell for this government. It can't be otherwise. And what we need to do is point out what is due to Brexit and what isn't, because the government will try to blame everything on the pandemic now. Whatever happens, the queues in Kent, the food prices, the fact that we probably will not have any further vaccines because they're going to get stuck on the border and melt and we have to fly them in by helicopter. All this will have nothing to do with Brexit, right? It's all the pandemic. We mustn't let the government get away with these kinds of excuses and lies. That is our task as an opposition going forward. And I think if we manage that, if we really relentlessly hold the government to account, we can eventually bring it down. And then we need to start very slowly to rebuild trust with our European partners and indeed our partners around the globe.
And rejoin the EU?
Yes, we will, but not within the next 10 or so years. I mean, let's not be naive about this. It takes two to tango. We need to rebuild that relationship of trust. And there are others who are waiting at the doors, desperate to get in. We need to show that we are going to be a trustworthy partner. That will take time, but I am confident we'll get there. I want to get my seat back in the European Parliament. I left a pair of shoes in a cupboard there. So even if they have to wheel me in a wheelchair, I want to be back. Reason.
Irina van Wiese, former member of European Parliament for the UK, and always a great commentator on political issues with great insight and somebody very pro-European. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Dana.
What does Europe think about Britain leaving its trading bloc? Well, most of the EU nations have gotten so tired of the debate it barely makes the newspapers. But there have been some very provocative, blunt assessments. The consensus seems to be British Prime Minister Boris Johnson misled his voters. Listen to one of Germany's European parliamentary representatives, Terry Reinke.
I might not like to say it, but I think it has to be said also here in this house. Boris Johnson has been lying to the people in the UK. The £350 million for the NHS after Brexit. No customs checks between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. And then this oven-ready deal that basically just needed signing on the future relations between the EU and the UK. Come on. These lies have to stop. If we want to turn this around, truth has to be spoken. First, Brexit is a mess. Second, finding a solution to this mess is not going to be easy for either side. But thirdly, and I think that this is important, there might not be a good outcome to this, but there are many different levels of how difficult this can become. So, Prime Minister, stop blaming others for your own actions. Take responsibility and come back to the negotiation table and avoid the worst outcome for the people in the UK. You owe it to them. Thank you.
All right, I take you now to Brussels, and you get a chance to hear Terry Reinke live with us here on Backstory. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Dana.
Thanks for doing this. I mean, that soundbite that we just played, you criticized Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Britain, for his actions over Brexit, telling him to take responsibility, not to lie to the people of the UK. What was he lying about?
Well, I think already in the start of all this debate, the campaign that led to Brexit, the referendum, there were a lot of misconceptions and half-truths said. And I mean, the most obvious one is obviously this bus where, you know, people were told that there would be £350 million that would be spent for the NHS after Brexit. And I think that this kind of really went through the whole debate on Brexit. And then when he became prime minister, this continued. And I think it's really something that created a lot of frustration on the other side of the channel, because obviously, you know, there can be differences in opinion, but if we don't talk about the same facts, any kind of negotiations are just made impossible, basically. So I hope that we can, you know, continue our relationship based on facts and not on some spins by some spin doctors.
Do you think if the Conservative Party had been a little more straightforward and the pro-Brexit tears had not spun the truth as much as they did on issues like sovereignty, on immigration, do you think that the British public would have supported this, or do you think they would have voted no the first time?
Well, you see, counterfactual history is always a hard thing because obviously things turned out as they did. I still think that, I mean, I remember that the first hit on Google the day after the referendum was, what is the European Union in the UK? And I think it tells you a lot about what was the basis for a lot of people to take this decision on. And looking back, a lot of people who voted Leave say, you know, if I'd really had all the insight, I would have voted differently. So I think it also gives us a lesson that if we ask people people to take a decision in a referendum, we need to give them all the information and we need to provide them with a plan. What do we want to do with the outcome? And if we want to have a credible debate and then obviously a credible decision by the people. So I would
what
say
was that the vote about fear, do you think, when you look at Britain from the European mainland and you go, why on earth did they vote for Brexit when they don't even know how to do Brexit? They don't know how to exit the EU. They want independence, but they're negotiating a trade dependence. I mean, what on earth do you think the vote was about, really?
Well, I think it was about something that is deeply emotional. You know, this claim of take back control. This is something that really speaks to like a feeling of independence, freedom, liberty that, you know, a lot of people are very, I think, open towards. And then when we were talking about
sovereignty,
very much, yes. Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the two campaigns, the Vote Leave campaign versus the Better Together or Stronger Together campaign, you could really see the one side was appealing to people's emotions, you know, taking back control, freedom and all this. And the other side was giving you all the best data and facts why economically it's smart to be in the European Union. But I don't think that there was like even like a balanced discussion, because the starting points of the two debates were so different. And I think we have to learn from that. We also have to appeal to people's emotions, because this is the starting point where a lot of people take decisions on.
Do you see parallels between what happened in America with Donald Trump and the pro-Brexit vote, this kind of populism, not really based a lot of it on reality?
Definitely. And I think that, I mean, the sentiment that Donald Trump was trying to push in people and what the Brexit campaign was trying to do, I think has a lot of similarities. And I think now, I mean, very happily, Donald Trump is not going to be the US president very much longer.
No, you're kidding. Nobody told him yet. No, they told him. He just hasn't digested it.
Yeah. I think he still hasn't realized, probably. And I hope that the same will happen in the UK, that people will realize at some point, you know, there can be these great spins and great slogans and great emotional appeals. But in the end, talking about facts and looking at what is realistically possible is still the basis of, you know, reality and what we can do politically. And I hope that, you know, if there is going to be a deal and then for the future relations between the EU and the UK, this sentiment is really going to come back. Look, we have a lot of things in common. We have a lot of interests in common. Let's try to work together as much as we can.
Well, never let the facts get in the way of a good political campaign, I guess. I mean, you know, they don't want a level playing field. So they don't want to meet the same standards on the environment. They don't want to meet the same standards or be stuck in the same standards of labor rights. They don't want to be stuck in the same standards of human rights, but they want access to the European common market. Where is the disconnect there?
Well, I think that this whole campaign and, you know, Boris Johnson's negotiation strategy was based on the illusion that that would be possible, you know, that we could just claim that we can have our cake and eat it and then it's going to become reality. But this is not how the world works. And I think that this is also dawning now to the British side. And I hope that in the end, rationality is going to prevail and we are going to get a deal and we can work together in the future as closely as possible.
But even if they have a deal, do you think that they're going to commit to resolving differences by a European court? Or, I mean, in the end, they need to be able to tell the British people that they have sovereignty and there is no mechanism in place in that agreement that will bind Britain to European standards and that they're still free and sovereign. So how do you see an agreement actually working? I mean, is it smoke and mirrors in the end?
Well, you see what happened with the internal market bill and, basically a couple of months after signing and ratifying the withdrawal agreement, already planning to break it. I think a lot of trust has been broken on the European side. And I think that this is not something that is going to be easily mended. But I still hope that in the end, also the British side in these negotiations and for the future, for, you know, whatever kind of interdependence we are going to have, that they are going to realize that this multilateral rules-based world order is something that we all benefit from. And it's something that actually the British have very much helped to build. So it is something that the British should be proud of and, you know, continue to support. And I hope that this is going to come back. And what gives me hope in this is the decision recently taken in the US. You know, Donald Trump had his 4 years and now it's over. So in the end, populism can be defeated. And I hope that the same will be true in the UK as well.
Do you think the Britain will rejoin the EU, that it's inevitable 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Well, you see, the last speech I gave in the European Parliament was this year. I was 32 then, and I said that I, in my lifetime, am going to see British MEPs being re-elected to the European Parliament. I do believe that, but I also hope that I'm still going to have a long life. So I'm not going to tell you that it's going to happen in 5 or 10 years, but I think at some point, especially in a world where, you know, a lot of adversarial powers are, you know, fighting with each other, if you want to call it that. I hope that in the UK, a majority will understand that having very close partners and allies under an umbrella such as the European Union in the continent, where they're going to continue to be geographically based, is something that is very important and powerful, and that then eventually they're going to come back to the EU.
So what happens to the rest of the European Union, Terry, if Britain does get a trade deal? Isn't there a danger of other countries within the EU, like Hungary, like Poland, that don't exactly like some of the human rights standards and on same-sex marriages? There's a host of issues, free press. What do you think that they're going to say? Aren't they going to say, well, hey, maybe we can have this free trade deal, but we don't need to apply the same standards, the democratic human rights standards of the EU. So maybe we'll go out too. Isn't that a danger?
Well, you know, a lot of people talked about that. And then when you look at what Brexit actually did in the rest of the European Union, if you look at the Eurobarometer numbers, it really pushed up the approval rates of membership of the European Union in all other member states.
So it worked in reverse.
Exactly. And people
don't want to go through this Brexit problem that Britain's had now for 4 years.
Exactly. And I think that also, if you will see what kind of, even if there is going to be a trade deal, what kind of loss there is going to be economically, but also politically for the UK with this Brexit, it's not going to be a very big success story. So I'm not afraid that because of that, other member states would leave. I would rather think that there might be other reasons that, you know, could be a danger for the European Union, especially if we don't stand up to these tendencies that I believe you were referring to, authoritarian tendencies in countries like Poland and Hungary. But again, you know, the European Union is not something set in stone. The European Union is also what we make of it. So I hope that in the future we are going to take smart decisions here in Brussels and in the capitals of the EU and then continue to build this project.
Why do you think it's not going to be a very good deal for Britain in the long run? You don't think that they're going to have economic prosperity by being kind of, you know, a distant neighbor?
Well, you see, for me, the UK had the best deal it could have being member of the European Union, because if you look at it, they already had a lot of exceptions, actually. So they had a little bit an EU a la carte. They were sitting around the table. They were influencing the decisions. They're not going to be able to do that anymore now. And I think in terms of, if we really want to speak about sovereignty, I really think it's also an illusion to believe the less you are actually cooperating with others, the more sovereign you are. I think what is much more powerful is that you sit here at the table in Brussels and you actually, you know, pull the others in your direction and influence their decision making. And this is what the UK is going to lack in the future. I think it's a big loss politically and economically. We will see that. And this is also why I hope that in the future, the tide will turn again.
Can I just ask you one last question? And that is, it's a complete right-hand turn. That is because of where we are in 2020 at the end of a pandemic. You're in Germany. You are going through a very severe lockdown in a lot of places right now. How are you, and how do you think the country is faring?
Well, I think right now, I mean, it's the lockdown that I think a lot of countries had already been through, at least in the European Union, and Germany was maybe a little bit later with the second wave. And it's a very, very challenging debate in Germany because obviously, I mean, you pay a price for all of this.
I deleted a long time. He's not a close friend, but he's a long time acquaintance that I worked with who lives in Germany. And he started saying that these measures are fascist. And I tried to reason with him a little bit. And in the end, I deleted him from my Facebook page and made it quite public that I didn't want those kind of people on my Facebook or those kind of people that I really don't agree with, because I think Germany's struggling reluctantly to limit rights and freedoms so that people are going to stay safe. I mean, they're trying to save lives. Merkel's generally doing a pretty good job, I think. But I wanted your opinion.
Well, you see, we recently had a study made commissioned from our group in the European Parliament, and we talked about this very, I think, delicate balance between restricting people's freedoms, which, you know, in a pandemic like this, if you want to get it under control, you have to do to a certain extent, and also using this in a way, and I think that this happened in some member states, also in the European Union, to maybe, you know, have a backlash on some democratic measures, what you could see, for example, in Hungary. And you could see that everywhere, including in Germany, rights and freedoms were restricted. But obviously, they need to be focused on a certain end, you know, like getting the pandemic under control. They need to be time limited and they need to be proportional. And in the end, when we look back, I think a lot of the measures that have been taken, you know, then with the knowledge that we will have, we may be put in question. But I think if they are always done in order to get this pandemic under control, and they're time limited and they're proportional, we will also have to pay a certain price to fight against this virus. And this is, I think, very much what the German government is trying to do, with a lot of challenges there, because, you know, Germany is a federal state. So we also have the Länder that have a lot of competence in all of this, which has made it, I think, a little bit more difficult. But at the same time, having said this, I can also see that for a lot of people, what is happening right now is a very, very big challenge. And I mean, I talk about the economic difficulties that a lot of people are going through, but also what this means for people personally, you know, people who live in very small apartments, who cannot meet friends and family, who cannot go out, people who have children, maybe when the schools and the childcare facilities are closed. So I think we have to take certain steps, but at the same time, we always have to see what does this mean in people's everyday lives and how can we make the situation as bearable as possible for everyone.
Terry Ranke, great to talk to you. You're a member of the Green Party, you're a member of European Parliament for Germany. Terry is completely forthright, bold, speaks with no limits, I think, and in a reasonable way. And it's great to hear your views. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Dana.
And finally, back to the UK. And we talked to one of our regular commentators on Backstory for her take on Brexit and the pandemic, a perfect economic storm. I want to bring in Joe Phillips. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Dana.
Joe Phillips is a commentator, and we've done a number of broadcasts together. So, Joe, first of all, I mean, let's talk about where we are. Michel Barnier, you know, talks were supposed to break up between the European Union and Britain on Sunday. Suddenly, they've now extended yet again. Barnier is sounding a little more optimistic, but they both sides say they're far away from a deal right now. But it looks like there could be a mechanism that they can agree to on trade if there is a conflict over a particular sector, and some kind of you know, resolution to that, whether it be in the courts, European courts, nobody has said.
Well, I think things are a little bit more optimistic than they were a week ago. I mean, we've had mixed messages coming out of Brussels and out of London. You know, last week it was all over. We were heading for no deal, no question. And as you say, the talks went on with Ursula von der Leyen and Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, over the weekend. But, you know, we are stuck with December the 31st. That is enshrined in law. So whatever happens, we are coming out. That is the end of our well, we're out anyway, but that's the end of the transition period. Now, it is quite possible that they might be able to pull something out of the hat and carry on talking. But of course, for businesses, you know, with just 3 weeks to go and Christmas and COVID, the perfect storm that you alluded to, it's a very, very, very uncertain time. And, you know, the economy is not looking great, as it is around the rest of the world, is being hit very badly by coronavirus. But, you know, here where I'm talking to you from in Kent, you know, we've got lorry parks all ready to go, and we've seen tailbacks.
Let's talk about first this really sexy thing called the level playing field.
Oh, I love it.
I'm being completely facetious, but level playing field means essentially that, okay, Britain leaves the European Union, but they want to trade with the European Union. They want independence, but they want interdependent trade. If that hasn't confused you enough, I'll keep going. But if, for instance, Britain starts deregulating industry, labor practice, environmental practice, making goods cheaper to produce here, then the EU would cry foul and they would say, wait a minute. Or if the British government starts subsidizing certain industry, the European Union will say that's not a level playing field. And there will have to be some penalty because you are going to undersell businesses or factories in the European Union. Have I got that right?
Yeah, pretty much. And I think, you know, there's a whole raft of stuff which refers to environmental standards, food standards, workers' rights, workers' protection. I mean, we've already seen this government in this country has relaxed the rules on the number of hours that lorry drivers can be behind the wheel in order to be able to sit in queues at Dover or on the other side of the channel. So, you know, you can understand, and it seems to me that it's perfectly legitimate that you, if you're going to trade, you have to trade on an equal playing field. That you then get into, if you want to talk really sexy, you then get into the ratchet agreement, which is the bit that Britain has really, really got cross about, that Brussels basically wants to say, well, you know, as things change, as, you know, different technologies come to light, different processes, what have you, they want the right to change what creates that, not so much the level playing field, but to make sure that you're trading on equal terms. I mean, there are two levels to this.
As you would in any country.
Exactly.
As you would in any country where there's a free trade agreement. I mean, I come from Canada, and Canada has a U.S. free trade deal with the United States. If Canada starts dumping lumber or dumping steel or doing any of those things, then the U.S. can bring in sanctions or say it's a violation of the free trade agreement. And then what they would do is they would have a mechanism between them to try and work that out. But Britain wants to leave. They want to sell into the European Union because that's the biggest trading block for them. That's the biggest buyer of their goods. But they don't want to have any mechanism if they suddenly undercut European business.
No, and I think, you know, from a European point of view, and for certainly those of us who think the whole thing's a very bad idea, it looks as though the British government wants to have their cake, eat it, and then lick the knife afterwards. And they're not prepared to budge on anything. But it does seem as though there is a little breakthrough. I mean, whether or not it comes to anything, but that may unlock, you know, the rest of the sticking.
If it doesn't unlock, there's that picture on the screen there of trucks lined up at places like Calais, which is the French port that brings, you know, tens of thousands of trucks into the United Kingdom, medical goods, food. Incredibly, you live here and you hear them daily. But for a lot of people around the world, they don't understand how dire some of the warnings are, what will take place here if trucks suddenly cannot properly cross the border.
Well, there was a guy who's got a haulage company. He had 64 lorries, and he said he was speaking the other day and said, "I've cut my fleet to 4 because I can't afford to have 60 lorries sitting in queues." And I mean, they've been doing practices over the last couple of weeks. Seems like a really crazy idea this late in the day. And lorries are queuing for 5, 6, 7 hours. And the government has already said they would expect lorries to be queuing perhaps on either side of the channel for 48 hours. And the only exemptions on this, you may laugh, are live chicks and fish. But, you know, what does that mean to salad crops and fruit and vegetables? What? We import 75% of stuff from Europe. And, of course, the other thing for the trucking companies is they don't want to come over with full loads and then go back empty. And they certainly don't want to go back and sit there.
A lot of people don't realize what's been taking place here over the last few weeks. Are big grocery stores like Sainsbury's and Tesco, and they've been stockpiling. They've been told to stockpile at least 6 weeks in advance. Food prices are already going up 5%. And by the way, Joe, I know this is a right-hand turn, but you've just reminded me. They're saying that the burrata, which I love, the burrata cheese, probably will not make the journey very well because it'll get stuck at the border and it'll spoil.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a burrata disaster. It's going to mean, you know, everything take for granted is going to cost a lot more. Olive oil, pasta, tomatoes, salad crops, fruit and vegetables, citrus fruit. You know, it couldn't happen at the worst time of the year. You know, what have we got to offer in Britain? Well, at the moment, it's Brussels sprouts, and they're rather soggy because they're underwater.
Let's move on to the next slide. I feel like I'm doing a home viewing here.
And it's like home schooling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a UK warship. And Boris Johnson's government has said that they're going to send warships into the English Channel because once there is no trade deal, then the French are going to be pushed out of British waters. The majority of fishing boats in there are European fishing boats, and just not French, but Dutch and different countries come in there. Most of the fish that is taken here by British fishermen is sold into the European Union anyway. Fish accounts for
0.4%
of the economy.
Yeah, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny part of GDP, but it is very totemic, as it is around Europe, actually, and all fishing countries, but it's particularly so in England because we are an island nation. But the idea that we would put our warships around our coastal waters to threaten or deter NATO partners is frankly embarrassing. It is ridiculous and has been widely condemned by, you know, military and service experts and the chairman of
the Defence Secretary of Britain came out today and said that it needed to be done.
The Defence Secretary, yes, indeed. But the chairman of the much more influential Commons Defence Committee, a former military man himself, said it was embarrassing. I mean, you know, people from the old days, the good old days of a different sort of Conservative Party, which wasn't nationalistic, based on personality and based on this particularly ridiculous right-wing agenda of nationalism and isolationism, have come out and roundly condemned it. It is utterly ridiculous. You know, we, as you say, export most of the fish that we catch in these waters to Europe. And there's always been an argument with British fishermen who feel as though they've been unfairly penalised because there have been limits on stocks and they're supposed to throw back undersized fish. And they say, oh, you go to any fish market in France or Spain, look at the sprats, the small fish that are on for sale there. So, you know, that's not going to go away.
Anyway, it's one of those political discussions, because when the government starts explaining level playing field and trade sanctions to the public, their eyes glaze over. But when we talk about fish in territorial waters, somehow Boris Johnson's government thinks that that's more appealing and more sellable. As we speak, the European Union is sitting with the United Kingdom, and they are very close to either having a deal, a trade deal, or very close to having talks completely collapse and Britain emerge in January with no trade deal with its biggest trading partner, which is Europe. So, Joe, how does this end?
I don't think it's going to be a happy ending, but I think it could be slightly less bad if we end up with some deal. Some deal gives you a sliver of hope. No deal gives you no hope. We will be, you know, we are already a diminished country, a diminished nation. I think our standing around the world has gone completely downhill, not least because of the threats and the willingness that was exposed of Boris Johnson's government to break international law. I mean, they have removed that from the treaty. But don't forget, Dana, that even if we get some sort of deal, it has still got to be ratified by the European Parliament. It's got to be you know, logistically, it's got to be translated into 24 different languages. And all of that has got to be done before the 31st of December. So, you know, we're on a very, very tight deadline here. I would like to think we come out with a deal, because a deal has got to be better than no deal. I don't have the faith in the Prime Minister that he will not just walk away and leave us dangling over a cliff edge.
Does it, at the end of this, and my last question to you, is it not ironic in so many different ways that Britain was sold Brexit, leaving the European Union, to have its sovereignty, to be independent, which a lot of people say they had their sovereignty and they're independent anyway, but that's how it was sold to the British people who supported the referendum. And now nobody understands quite why Boris Johnson's government is having so much trouble negotiating a deal that is all about interdependence, because that's what you have to do with your trading partner.
Well, exactly. But, you know, Boris Johnson was saying, you know, he's been in power, been in number 10 for exactly a year. He won with a huge majority. And he has been talking for years about having this oven ready deal. Well, now it appears he hasn't even got an oven, never mind anything to put in it. And the number of people who say, oh, if I'd known it was going to be like this, I wouldn't have voted leave.
Yeah.
I mean, the challenge, I think, and I know we're coming to the end of this, but the challenge for us, whatever happens, is how you begin to rebuild a country that is not based on, well, you voted for this, this is your fault. We have to somehow or other together work our way out of it. And it may be that, you know, if we can leave the door open a little bit, there will be a room for another government in years to come to make a better relationship with Europe. But at the moment, as you say, it is utterly ridiculous. We've been banging on about sovereignty and independence, and here we are now trying to create something that is so determined on interdependence of our European partners.
Jo Phillips, great to talk to you again. And yeah, here we are. And at the worst possible time, when the economy is already on its knees with COVID-19, and they are rapidly approaching January, where if they get a trade deal, it will be interesting if they can actually, as you said, get it through Parliament, get it through the European Union, which I think they probably will in the end, if they can sign off on a deal and have the support of France and Germany and the majors. But at the same time, they're very close to teetering on the edge of not having a deal as well. So, Jo, good to talk to you.
And you, and I dare say we will return to this subject one way or the other before very long.
We will. Thank you so much.
And that's our backstory. Rumors of some kind of trade deal are rampant. Britain is not likely to completely drop out of the EU with no deal, because more than 50% of its trade goes to the EU. And it's got all those fish to sell as it renews its territorial claims over its waters. It will lose a lot of financial services to the EU. Banks and insurance companies and legal services have already shifted to places like Madrid and Paris and Frankfurt and even Ireland. In 2018, the financial services sector, by the way, contributed £132 billion to the UK economy. That's about 7% of total economic output. The sector was the largest in London, and they can kiss a lot of that goodbye. What's interesting is the opposition parties in Britain are sitting quietly, no longer campaigning for a new referendum, because they think voters will not clearly support that yet. And they don't want to tell the British people, "We told you so," that Brexit was a disaster, because in politics, voters don't like that either. You can't seem to be celebrating someone's misery. So the opposition parties in the UK, that's Labour and the Liberal Democrats, are paralysed and seem to have no strategy. It'll take a few years for everyone to say Brexit was a complete mistake, probably after Scotland leaves the UK and rejoins Europe's trading bloc, which is now very likely. So economic breakup will bring the breakup of the Union. From London, I'm Dana Lewis. Thanks for listening to Backstory. Please share our podcast, and I'll talk to you again soon.